This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Inderst, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Stefan Höltgen about his new book, Open History. His book is based on his CSD thesis in computer science, where he tried to find an alternative way to think about computer history. When common historiographies regularly focus the computer either as an economic scientific tool or build investor stories and anecdotes around it, Stefan Höltgen tries to make the computer tell itself about its history in terms of an alien historiography. Here, hardware, software, and knowledge are no artifacts but operative matters that only exist in presence. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Stefan, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. Of course, including your favorite game and gaming hardware you're playing on right now.
Okay. I think I will start with the last part. My favorite gaming hardware is any computer, any analog or digital computer, and my favorite game is the game of life, which is not a proper game in the sense of video gamings we are speaking about today, but a kind of experiment from the 1960s, 1970s, where the computer plays against itself and where you can use the game for different purposes, like finding out about how the computer functions and learning about automat theory and making nice pixel graphics and learning about storage technologies and so on. So I'm not a regular video gamer, but more a kind of scientific gamer. Hmm. Yeah, that's one point of my biography I can tell you about. After finishing my studies in Jena in the beginning of the 2000s, I moved to Bonn to do my PhD, and there I worked on a discourse analysis of serial killer movies. I tried to find out about how the topics of violence and the topics of criminology are discussed within the movies, and if there is an exchange between culture and the movies. And I finished that PhD thesis in 2009. And then I moved to Berlin to become a postdoc at the Department of Media Science there at the Humboldt University. And there I did a research project called The Archaeology of Early Microcomputers and Their Programming, which of course uses a bit different term of archaeology, not the term you know from Indiana Jones, but more you know from Michel Foucault. And there in Berlin at Humboldt University, Friedrich Kittler and others started in the 1980s, 1990s to make a kind of new archaeology based on Michel Foucault, which they called media archaeology. And I used this media archaeology to examine computer history. Okay, so when I first thought of doing an habilitation on this topic, I found out that there would be no supervisor at the faculty. So I changed my mind and moved to the computer science department. And there I found someone who would make an SCD thesis or supervise this as an SCD thesis. And so I finished this as an SCD thesis in 2020. And then I made this book, Rudolf told about Open History, the archaeology of retro computing. Right now, after 11 years, I'm about to finish my job there at Humboldt University and change back to Bonn, to the media studies there, to start a research project on the cultural history of BASIC programming. BASIC is a computer programming language established in the 1960s for liberal arts students, and not for computer scientists or mathematics, but it soon changed into culture or moved into culture, where at the beginning of the 1970s, those small computers, the home computer era starts, and all of those computers had built-in BASIC interpreters, and a huge load of hobbyistic programs and especially BASIC games came to life. And this archive of BASIC games is the topic of my new research project. I want to find out about how did the people back in the day program their games in BASIC? Are there different styles to find? Are there differences between English game programmers and German game programmers and French programmers and so on? And this will last for the next 3 years and hopefully conclude in a new book. That's all I have to say.
Right now, of course, I hope. Yeah. So I want to circle back to the book itself, Open History. Please tell us a bit more about how did you come to write it in the first place?
Yeah. Regularly, if you're doing a doctorate, you have to write a thesis. And this book is based on the thesis. I used a trick that I already used with my first thesis. I published the original thesis as a PDF on the servers of the university to gain my doctor certificate. And then I had the opportunity to change some parts of the book and to put other pictures into it and to publish as a regular book. Yeah. And this book is fresh on the market. It came out in early August. And it concludes, of course, the whole SCD thesis, but some more parts and an index and, as I said, more pictures. It is not straight about games and gaming, but more since its topic is retro computing. Of course, there are retro games discussed into the book, and the topic of software preservation is an important topic of the book. So, software preservation is a topic for game history and for other software genres as well. And I try to find out there, within other topics, how to preserve game history and keep it operative so that you could play the games. What tools do we need? Do we need the real hardware? Do we need emulators? How can we preserve the gaming process and the games to play them again and again, even today when the old hardware does not exist? Yeah, but that's just one of the topics of the book. Since the supervisor from my SCD thesis came from the didactics of informatics, I had to choose a topic which is entangled with didactics. And as I said earlier, back in the 1970s and 1980s, people learned programming with their small computers and mostly were autodidacts and worked with trial and error processes to learn about their computers and learn about programming. And I wanted to find out if these trial and error processes and learning by doing processes, this kind of didactics is entangled with the Foucauldian term of gaining to knowledge in our culture. And I planned the heart of the book as four experiments I did with the students, where I had to give seminars at the media science department there in Humboldt University, and we did retro computing projects there to find about how we are doing this, even if we are no technicians or if we are no computer scientists or programmers. And these experiments are focused on four topics, as I said earlier, on video games and simulation topics with Game of Life, or on hardware preservation projects, how to repair an old computer, even if I'm not a repairman, or on the question of emulators and video gaming with old computers, old hardware, and with the question of programming languages and how programming and programming languages are connected to natural languages, if I borrow or if I copy an algorithm from one program and put it into my own program, is it just copyright infringement, or can it be seen as a kind of reception, like in literature, when someone borrows a topic from the literature history to use it in its own novel, in his own novel?
I see. So first of all, let me thank you for this tiny PhD publication, a life hack you are actually providing here. So our listeners will appreciate that, I'm pretty sure. Let me start by telling you, when I first read through your book, I had the impression, and please correct me here if I'm wrong, that you actually dedicate more pages to the current state of research within your field as one would normally expect within a PhD. So is this observation correct? And if so, why is it of such significance to you?
I think it's correct. I came from the outside. I came from the humanities. I regularly studied literature studies in the 90s, and I had nothing to do with computer science besides my hobbyistic interests. And when I moved to the computer science department to do this SCD thesis, I thought I had to learn about computer science and informatics and put as much as I learned about that topic and as much knowledge as I gained about that topic into my SCD thesis. And then I found out that there are really original ideas from the humanities departments and from the media studies I worked on, which are very unknown by computer scientists. They don't think about their own history in such terms as a historian would do, and so it was more like let me say teaching computer science computer scientists about the ways of historiography and the ways of criticism of historiography we all know about since the early 20th century in the humanities. So since they are more in techniques and they are more in building and they are more in progress and not so much in looking backwards and analyzing their own history, it was a kind of job for me to bring this back to establish a kind of interdisciplinary discourse between the computer sciences and the media studies. So this is why I'm very heavily focused on the research topics and on the research discourses we have in media studies about these things I said earlier, like preservation and simulation and so on. And on the other side, it's this that the media studies, especially in Germany, are regularly not very entangled with technology. They are speaking about technology and they are using technology and there are debates on technology and its influence on society and on culture. But these discussions and discourses are not technologically. So you will rarely find a code, or you will rarely find a schematic from a computer board within such discourses, because there are some kind of hurdles that had been built between the humanities and the MINT, the STEM departments, and I tried to like break down these hurdles a bit to tell the humanities about technology and the ideas that you can get if you think more technologically about techniques, and on the other side to teach the computer scientists and the STEM departments to think more about the epistemologicals and the archaeological ways of their topics.
Yeah, this is quite a good observation. It reminds me of the sheer endless talks we had on game studies conferences when it comes to the enormous gap between the theoretical sides of game studies or game research and the actual game designers or game developers, right?
Yeah, this is one. I'm more or less a kind of exotic participant on those conferences or even in essay collections when it comes to write a book about a specific topic on games, that I always bring in or try to bring in some technology and some technical stuff into the discourse to enrich the discourse from this side. And I think it is nearly impossible to talk about games and not at least think about the technological side, just on the discourses and aesthetics, talking about about the discourses and aesthetics would more or less lead into a kind of problem that computer gaming and video gaming is a kind of technological thing to do, and it connects the human body to a machine. And this is of Rudolf the first thing I wrote about in one of your books, connecting an analog body of the player to the digital machine, and how to make them speak about is not just a topic of sociology or of psychology, but also of technology.
Yeah, and I can definitely confirm hereby that whenever we work together on such books or anthologies, it's a very enriching lecture. Whenever a new text from you comes in, I have to really dig in, you know, to understand. But it's rewarding, right? Because it opens up my perspectives over the years so much. So it's a really good job. Great job you're doing there.
Yeah, thank you.
In your next chapter, you introduce the concept of computer archaeology regarding its theoretical and methodological background. Could you please elaborate a bit on this in order to get a better understanding for our listeners?
Yeah, of course. As I said earlier, this all is based on the ideas of media archaeology stemming from Wolfgang Ernst and Friedrich Kittler from the 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s. And media archaeology always had been two kinds of sciences. One is a methodological way, and the other is the theoretical way. The methodological way is interested in looking on historiographies, how historiographies are written, what are the powers that figure historiographies. As we learned from Foucault, there are dispositives that build historiographies and any other discourses, and what are the ways the matters that are let it put it in another way. If a matter like a computer is to be described in an historiography, there's something can't be put into words, can't be put into ideas, into human language. And these are the things media archaeology is interested in a methodological way, to find out how to properly describe technological things or media technology in historiographies. Can they be of written media history, or is a written media history always does it always lack some ideas that can't be put into words? And how to find methods to do it anyways? So, and the theoretical way strongly depends on this methodological thinking. It tries to find out, together with Foucault and Friedrich Kittler, how to how history, thinking about history and historiographical writing depends on specific ideas of culture, on specific ideas we have in our minds, and on specific ways we write our historiographies. And for the theoretical way, I use two thinkers tell about the problem. The first is Hayden White, most history scientists and historians. Hayden White's works are well known from the 1980s. He tried to find out if there is any connection between fictional writing and writing historiographies, writing history. And he established a kind of meta history. And this meta history tried to find out what were the ways historians wrote down their historical ideas. And he found out it's very similar to the ways fictional authors write down their fictions. So we have to think about the story, and we have to put things into our story and leave other things that not good for the story, or leave those things out. And the other thinker was Robin Collingwood from the 1940s, a philosopher. And Robin Collingwood had the interesting idea of the reenactment. He said historical thinking is always a reenactment of history. So we can't think about the past. Anytime we think about a thing that had been happened in the past, we get it into the presence, and we are thinking right now about this, and we are working in our heads with the historical ideas to make them present ideas. And both ways, from Hayden White to criticize the discursive way to write about history, and the ideas of Robin Collingwood to say that everything happens in the moment, even thinking about the past, I put together as a theory for computer archaeology. So I think about computers and about the writing of computers, and I examined four or five different historiographies to point to the ways they wrote down their stories in terms of Hayden White. And I try to establish a theory that can be used properly to describe computers and their past, where computers are not only hardware that had been put into the shelves of any museum, but there are operative media technology that are always in presence. So if you switch on your Commodore 64, you won't be back in 1982, but your Commodore 64 from 1982 is in 2022. And you are doing things you are doing right now with it, like Robin Collingwood said. So, but how to write about that? How can I write a book about computer archaeology when I first said that writing is not the proper way to speak about computers? So I try to establish some ways and some methods putting ideas onto paper. And the first thing is using mathematics and electronics and programming languages. And as you probably have seen, the book is full of diagrams and program code and things like that, that shows in quite another way how computer operations are going on than just speaking about that. And the other way was to find out that even this is not sufficient to tell about a computer process that happens right now. You have to demonstrate it. So, as you will know from conferences of game studies, playing some seconds a game to show the audience what the game is like is way more better than just speaking about it. So let the computer demonstrate itself. Let it put the things you are speaking about in a non-human way to show the audience what it does, and not to speak about that. And these two things, the theoretical way and the methodological way, I put together and called it computer archaeology.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking about when I talk about video game essays, for example, we often do wonder how we can bypass this paradigm of text-centered works in when it comes to game studies, right? Because we do talk about games, and we describe them, and we try to describe them the most accurate way possible, but it never comes close to the actual seeing it in action in real time going down. Plus, and this doesn't include at all the simple experience of gameplay itself. So it's really tricky to conceptualize such works, right?
Yeah. I think you always have to have a theoretical part where you speak about that, and then invite the audiences to come in front and play some rounds of the game and try it out for themselves to get another idea. But of course, it's not always possible to do this. But I try to do this as often as I can. And when I write text about that, I regularly put code into the text and ask the readers to copy and paste the code to an emulator to find out about the process by themselves. But it's, of course, not always possible with any kind of game or game studies topic to do this.
Yeah. Well, that's a good opportunity to talk about actual practical work, because your fourth chapter then has quite a package in store. Altogether, you discuss the aforementioned four retro computing projects that took place within your academic teaching in recent years. And now we all know how hard it is to name your favorite child, but let's try it anyway. Would you please take us through one of these four projects and, of course, your findings?
Yeah, that's hard, of course. But I chose, if I shall choose one, I would choose the one of games and simulations, which is the most game studies-like chapter in the book. It all starts with the idea of Klaus Piers and his famous Computer Game Worlds book, where he speaks about the invention of Pong. The Pong game from Atari from 1972. And there are some paragraphs in Piers' book where he compares the Pong game to to Ralph Baer's Magnavox Odyssey table tennis game, and that there were quite different technologies. And as I said earlier, Klaus Piers did this only from the surface, from the viewpoint to the surface. So it looks similar, and if we open the machine, we see quite different technologies. But he doesn't go into detail, and this is one thing I wanted to do in two ways. I wanted to find out how tennis games came to the world of video gaming, and why tennis games are. Had been the first topic of video games. And for this, I did some experimentations, as I said earlier, with the students of media studies. First, I made a seminar on computer game programming in analog and digital computers. And for this chapter, I took the analog part since we reenacted the Tennis for Two game from William Higginbotham from 1957 on an analog computer we had, or we have there at the Media Studies Department. And we tinkered around with the machine to learn how to program it. It's a quite different way than digital computer programming. And we managed to implement Tennis for Two on this machine. And starting from this, we moved on to program a Pong game for the Commodore 64, our very own Pong game on the Commodore 64. And but these games are one thing, and on the other side, Klaus Pierce spoke about bouncing balls. That bouncing balls are the cause for people to think about playing tennis with the computer. Since to simulate a bouncing ball, you would need some physics and you would need some mathematics. And William Higginbotham implemented both of it into his analog computer in 1957 when he used a ready-made bouncing ball simulation for his analog computer and let's say hacked it so it's not just a ball bouncing on the oscilloscope, but the ball could be played forth and back with two controllers, as we all know. And the implementation of the bouncing ball is very straight a physical and mathematical thing on the analog computer. You have to know about the laws of physics, the laws of speed and acceleration, and to learn about the falling of the ball and to implement it with analog circuitry. And I question myself if the other bouncing ball programs or even the other tennis games used this kind of physics in the same way William Higginbotham did this. So did people like Alcorn for the Pong arcade game, or later on the people who programmed the spectacular bouncing ball demo for the Amiga, for the Commodore Amiga in 1985, or even basic hackers in the 1980s, did they use the very same ideas of implementing physics into their demonstrations and games? So I opened those games, like I looked into the codes and the circuitry to find out, okay, how is the ball accelerated with Pong? How is the ball accelerated with the technology of Ralph Baer's Magnavox Odyssey? How was the idea of bringing the ball to bounce within the Amiga Boeing demo and the successes of that? And there I saw that we have a kind of tradition of implementing things like how to build a circle on the computer screen, or how to make the circle a ball that rotates, which is the Amiga bouncing ball demo showing, or how to implement a gravitation into the game so the ball falls down to Earth and bounces back again. And I try to compare these different ways of putting these algorithms or algorithmic ideas into different kind of programming languages and programming paradigms. And it was then when I found out that's not just computer science I did, but literature studies, literature history. Since the programming of an algorithm in a specific way, in a specific programming language, is much like adapt a specific topic, let's say from the Homerian Odyssey, in a new novel or a new kind of story. And so I opened the long forgotten toolbox of literature and literature studies and linguistics that was back in my mind, and tried to apply methods from the linguistics and the literature studies to examine code history and to tell about the reception processes in code history, focused on those bouncing ball and tennis games. And I think this worked very well, since the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, DFG, just funded a great research project based on this idea for this new BASIC project I told about.
Yeah, congrats to that. It's a great success, actually, yes. Especially in these, let's say, challenging times when it comes to anything related to a financial backup from these institutions. Your final chapter then deals with different ways of self-education in the field of computer science. You've already mentioned that. But you also bring this together with the idea of gamification. And we all know that's the big buzzword since back in the days, the early 2010s maybe. But what does this this combination then entail exactly for you?
When I came to the last the chapter about knowledge preservation and the question how people autodidactically learned programming back in the 1980s and how do retro computing enthusiasts learn about electronics and things today, even if they are not from the STEM. I try to figure out how what are the methods for autodidactical programming learning. As I said earlier, there are ways of learning by doing and trial and error processes. And this trial and error process holds a specific idea that you sit in front of your computer and you are starting your computer, and the computer asks you to enter some keywords or some commands in the programming language you use. So you type in a command and press return, and either it works and shows you the thing you want to see, or it doesn't work and gives you an error. If the computer gives you an error, it plays the ball back to you. So you will think about, oh, what did I do wrong to get this error? How can I correct myself and try it again and again? And in some way, you are in a kind of dialogue with the computing system. So this dialogue, I misused the term of e-learning, as we all know, learning with computer technology, to describe this dialogical process of learning. So since programming means you teach the machine a thing that it should do, and giving a feedback in form of errors, the machine teaches you the things you did wrong. So you can learn about doing it right, and the ball goes forth and back between you and the machine. And this is kind of is a kind of e-learning. And gamification comes to the discourse when you find out that you are, of course, you're an autodidact, but you are not a solipsist. So you live in a community, and there are other people who use the same computer or the same programming language as you do, and you start to compare with them. You start to send around code snippets and to use code snippets from others and to refine code snippets and to adapt ready-made programs you find in magazines. And then it comes to a challenge in between the communities. And this challenge features some aspects of gamification processes. So like uploading a game onto GitHub is to show your skills to others so that they can compare themselves with you, which is a thing most gamification processes do as well. When the gamification is put to other processes like learning mathematics, showing the results to others is a kind of feedback or a kind of force feedback others to do it as good as you did it. And these gamification processes, which is not the proper way of gamification, since there is no economic background for this or background that enforces in a direct way, but in a very indirect way to work on yourself and to learn more and to be better and to become better. This can be seen today and even back in the 1980s, when Sherry Turkle wrote her book The Second Self, she published it in 1984. She described school children in first grade, second grade, fourth, third and fourth grade, how they learned programming, the Logo programming language. And even there you can find these gamification processes where the kids exchanged their ideas and compared with each other and even got some kind of scores when they wrote their programs I could program this with only four lines and you used eight lines, so four is the score and eight is the score to compare with each other and other things like that. So this gamification is more or less like a, let's say, a metaphor for the interactive processes of gaining knowledge when we are not only by ourselves but within communities or within hacker spaces or within school classes to learn program.
I see. So let me think about this for a second. So this whole, so basically what you're saying is that this idea of gamification actually is of course much, much older than you would think if you just focus upon gamification as a buzzword, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And this is one thing you can read by Rolf, at Rolf Noor. He researches gamification and things like that and found out that there were even processes in the Middle Ages that could be described as gamification. So I would use the term. Ian Bogus suggested don't use the term gamification since it's a bad thing to do with computer games, to put them into quite different purposes onto different processes. But I would use it as a metaphor of a kind of playful interaction, a kind of playful interaction where the outcome is not only measured with money or with time or things like that, but with very, very things you gain from the specific era you're into. So in the 1950s, the students at MIT had a gamification process that was called code bumming, where the students tried to shorten codes others had written. So they had a drawer in the computer room, and inside this drawer were the computer codes stored from the other students. And every morning one opened that drawer, got out the codes, and said, "I can do this tighter, and I can do this better, and I can make a smaller thing of that," and wrote it and put it back into the drawer. So the next morning, others could get the code and bum it by themselves. And this is, of course, a gamification process. Even if there is no outcome in the new way gamification is about.
So one could even argue it's within this two poles of Ludus and Paida, that's Paida with benefits, right?
Yeah. Paida with benefits. Yes. Yeah. And I think every time we are switching on our computer, we are in a kind of game, in a kind of will it work? Can I use this computer for this purpose and so on?
Well, Stefan, we have taken up a lot of your time, actually. Tell us, what are you working on right now? I mean, you already have told us a bit about it. And, of course, what will you be playing next?
I did not talk very closely about the topic I'm working on right now, but it is more on proper computer games than the thing I did with Open History. The research project I told about is a basic programs that had been printed in magazines back in the 80s, which were more or less hobbyistic projects from teenagers and young adults who learned to program the computer by themselves and to programmed a nice game and sent in the code to that magazine, and the magazine published that game code. So I will focus on such game codes for different computer platforms from the 1980s, published in different computer magazines in different locations, like Germany, Eastern Europe, and America, and Great Britain. And I want to find out by looking at those codes how the specific way of programming computer games for those machines tells about the computer cultures back in the day and the gaming cultures when it comes to basic games and to, which is quite like public domain games today. This is why I would play many, many basic programmed games on my vintage computer platforms. I have a PlayStation 5 here and a PlayStation 3, and the kids have a Nintendo Switch, but I have no time to play Lost Horizon. The Horizon game. I just played 5 minutes of that because I always have to play basic games, which is quite more fun to me. So the next games I will play are for the Atari home computer, 8-bit home computer platforms, published in Germany, and I will play them for a talk I will give in November at the History of Games conference. Can tell about the titles of the games, but it surely will be basic games for the Atari 8-bit computers.
Okay, well, that sounds like a great project. Then I want to thank you for being on the show today, and I really enjoyed it. So please, Stefan, take care.
Thank you very much.
And goodbye.